on page 75A of the Talmud, right after where we mentioned about cucumbers and melons and onions and garlic in terms of the manna, and we're going to expand our conversation about the manna, about the man, and we're going to just note again the surprise that here we are in the middle of fasting and we're having such an extensive conversation about manna falling from heaven, which I find absolutely fascinating, as you can tell already, just incredible. And I'm going to follow up tonight a little bit on one aspect of the ritual studies questions we're asking too, that we talked about last time, vis-a-vis an article that looked for the roots of the practice of fasting and talked about the nature of Yom Kippur as a holiday, as it was experienced by Jews, those in Jerusalem, temple Jews and their experience, and Jews in the Qumran area and the Essene experience, or whatever the Qumran community really is to be called. And the angle that I'm going to touch on vis-a-vis that article we looked at, because we saw that there was kind of a debate, the basic debate there was, is this a day of fasting and mourning and deep kind of introspection and penitence, or is this a day that also has joy? And we noticed, and that article presented the possibility that in fact it was a day of joy, and that the joy that's part and parcel of that day was recorded in two places. One, that it was a Mishnah that the tenth of Tishrei, Yom Kippur, was this very incredible day of building the Jewish family, and that you have this sense that it's connected to Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av, which is kind of like the equivalent of Lahavdil, Jewish Sadie Hawkins Day. And you have the sense that as Shabbat Shabbaton, as a Sabbath, and it's full of delight, you also have a joyful time in the temple. And that the Kohen, who comes out of doing the worship service, comes and says, wow, here, I'm alive. Yontif, it's a party for everyone. And that kind of unbridled joy makes us feel like the joy we're talking about, and I would say in general, the joy we think of when we hear about joy and holiday, for most folks, is a joy that feels very connected to the kind of emotional life of happiness, of elation, of feeling elated, of celebration, a certain type of maybe even satisfaction. What are other words that we might associate with joy in general, in the religious sense? Fulfillment. Any others come to mind quickly? These are, I think, the words we normally associate. What I'd like to do is share that other words that come to mind if we look deeply at sources in the Torah and other places in rabbinic literature might be that simcha, this is likely to make its way back into one of the Yontif conversations that we'll have about joy at some point. In our services, because it's just fascinating work. But we might posit, given what we've said now, and given that's the normal way we think about it, that there are other ways to explain joy, qua joy, in the sense of simcha, the word simcha. And this article that I'll share from, that was in the Jewish Quarterly Review, written in 1990, called The Expression of Joy, and I'll leave it to the Jews, as a halachic problem in rabbinic sources, says the following. Let me tell you about Salman Schechter's outlook about what joy is. Let me tell you about what the scholar Urbach's sense of what joy is. And then let me tell you about Yochanan Mosk's an interpretation, meaning that I'm going to give you different scholars who had very different takes on the world. Schechter, whom we know a lot because he was kind of brought from the world of the Geniza Project in London, Britain, and headed up the Jewish Theological Seminary. We have schools named for him. He wrote about aspects of rabbinic theology, has a major book called that with several articles, wonderful articles, and his conception, though, was a little bit more anthropological in the sense that he noticed that joy was highlighted several times, perhaps because it was being contrasted to what some might lodge as criticism against the Jews, and that is we are so heavily burdened with law. And if that went back to before the Christian claim that they were the people of love and we were the people of justice and capital L, capital A, capital W, law, bearing down on our lives and bearing down on us, Schechter posited, maybe that was even part of what the kind of complaint or potential problem with following Judaism was, is even predating the landscape of Christianity and its claim against Yahadut, Judaism. But for sure, joy is so highlighted in Torah, especially by the rabbis who write joy into the sources, because we want to say it's not just about the oppressive sense of law and bearing down of our ritual, but it's about the deep joy, and then that's the kind of joy that we just defined. Happiness, elation, fulfillment, this kind of potentially even love one feels, that love arising from life, embodied life, possibility to celebrate, time, notice time, shecheyanu v'kiyamanu v'higyanu lezman hazeh, this kind of a joy. The article goes forward and says, well, Urbach has a little bit of a different take, not just the emotional disposition of the person who fulfills the commandment. In his opinion, sages create the concept of simcha shel mitzvah, the joy of doing mitzvot, and that one feels a certain amount of joy in the sense that there's gratification in not just there's gratification and happiness, not just in the sense of an emotional reaction, jubilation in that sense, but there's a sense of fulfillment, gratification, and joy when one obeys the Torah.
Accomplishment
might be the word. So I think that's right. So that leaves Professor Muffs, who was a professor within the seminary world and quite an incredible soul. His library was really nice. His Jerusalem-based library was really nice. Amy happened to live in an apartment that he owned in Jerusalem. 1994-95, she shared an apartment with some roommates. It was owned by Yochanan Muffs, who's mentioned here. A wonderful collection of old commentaries on Tanakh and lovely, lovely high ceilings. Anyway, he shows that simcha functions as a metaphor for one's willingness or desire to perform the law. So that you become a person when you are malei simcha, full of joy, as the one who is entirely willing to fulfill legal precepts. And from a ritual standpoint, that helps reduce any kind of mysterious nature of a commandment that says, I'm commanding you to be besimcha. I'm commanding you to be happy. Because how can anyone be commanded in their emotional lives? This is the kind of same question people have about the Shema. V'ahavta et adonai elokecha, love the Lord your God. Well, how am I supposed to be commanded to love anyone? Right? How can you command emotional life? part of the human fiber is to have an emotional life. But command an emotional life, that's even beyond the kind of legal outlook of Torah in a certain sense. There's not so many places. And so this one, where you're commanded to be joyous, it says in the Psalms, worship the God with joy and gladness, we usually translate. Come before God with a certain jubilation could very well mean worship God completely, willingly, and quote-unquote deny any resistance by overcoming it. And that could be more cognitive than it is emotional, by way of emotional life. Could very well mean with a liturgical formulation and a certain group of words that you say that accompanies this sacrificial action that you're doing, salvific action, in the ritual form that it exists in. So it answers this fundamental problematic question of emotional life being commanded in Torah. Which is fascinating. Because then when one's not completely basimcha, as we say, joyous and full of that emotional kind of fervor, they still could be very much willing to fulfill all the precepts. And that in and of itself could be the simcha the Torah has commanded. That means that Yom Kippur, if it's full of simcha, even if that's expressed a little differently by the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, because we will get a certain kind of element of emotional reality in the sense that these two are meeting and romance is flying, and you know, romance is so different for thousands of years before 200, 300 years ago, but if you will, there's connectivity in some way. We're talking about love making, we're talking about sex. In this context, it's not without its emotional kind of connectivity. The relationship to food we even have that makes us feel joy when we have such a banquet and we eat. There is emotional life that we're contending with, if you will. But the joy, the simcha element, may be come and do this with a full, willing heart and fulfill these precepts and fulfill these commandments.
Part of the Jewish pedagogy that first we will do and then we will believe.
How do you connect? How do you connect that?
At Sinai.
Yeah, so how do you connect that for me?
Well, by the act will encourage the emotion.
Yeah, I don't think you can get away from the fact that there is some sense of emotional life. Even if I just say, have simcha means be willing to do it and do it. I don't think you get away from, quote-unquote, the double entendre or the multiplicity of meaning of the word simcha. So yes, it is connected to the production of joy as we know it vis-a-vis an emotional life. Yes, I would say. But what's fascinating is that might be the, you know, if you will, human perspective versus the God perspective of God says, be willing to do my law. Humans say, I'll do the law and I'll feel happy. But God really wasn't interested in how you feel. Not to say that I necessarily believe that. And for sure, later on in our sources, you know, part of Rabbi Nachman's great Hasidic insight is, you know, Yivdu et Hashem simcha, mean Leo the simcha tamid, try to achieve joy and that kind of happiness always. Right? I think he's talking about emotional joy so that one doesn't have to feel despair. Though he was party to despair, he could know what joy really meant.
The last one by
Dr. Muffin.
I was trying to think of what that is referring to, and it might be opportunity or anticipation as distinguished from accomplishment. Right? The second was the joy of accomplishment. The other was opportunity, I think, and anticipation, the way you described it.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that the opportunity to fulfill God's law.
Right.
I wouldn't say just opportunity in general.
It's opportunity to fulfill fulfill the mitzvot.
Yeah, opportunity to fulfill the mitzvot. And therefore, mitzvot become opportunities to potentially engender joy, or just in and of itself to show that you've expressed what you are needing to express by way of the Torah's command, and that is simcha. Right? So, not that the joyous take on that, you know, also helps people who have a problem, like, it doesn't bring me any joy. Well, maybe it wasn't supposed to exactly the way you're thinking. But there's something very powerful about being willing to be, you know, producing the culture.
Joy of being given.
Not to say that I don't believe in joyous Jewish living.
Yeshayahu Leibovich has a book of letters that the Goraitim, and he writes back. One of the letters, I don't remember the details, but he writes back. He never says in anywhere in the Torah what you're supposed to feel. It only says what you're supposed to do. I'm sure his interpretation will be the same as Dr.
Basimov.
Yeah, that's his stand very clearly. It never says anything about what you're supposed to feel, not love, not joy, or anything. That's it. Not surprisingly, right?
Not surprisingly, coming from Yeshayahu Leibovich, right?
Not surprisingly from him. Yeah.
He says that not even supposed to engender questions, for real.
Uh-huh.
We can have our thoughts about different mitzvot and the different areas of, you know, what a mitzvah is connected to and how to do a mitzvah and why they had different agreements and disagreements. But, you know, one does the mitzvot because one is commanded to do the mitzvot.
Yeah.
Period.
Period.
Va'ita asameya by him is, and you mamash iskamta la'asorotam.
Willing.
And you absolutely agreed to do them. Not to say that I've
a lot of people don't agree with, you know.
Right. I mean, it's not easy to agree with because we want the production of joy.
I find I don't mind somebody saying to me, just prove your attitude. It's a matter of making a conscious decision. I'm not saying that you go from 0 to 100, but I see both sides of the argument. I'm not trying to take a strong position here, but I don't want to go all the way to saying, to negating the word simcha and saying, no, it's really just about being willing to take on, because that's not the same thing. So, you know, everything's an effort. I mean, tefillah is an effort. I mean, Kavanah is something that you need to make a conscious decision you're going to embark upon, and you don't succeed. I love using the analogy of old-style photography of things. When you start with photography, you have a roll of 36 exposures, and if one of them isn't good, you feel like you're screwed up, and then as you go through, you become, after many years, you're hoping to get one shot out of the 36, and then you have. So I think there's a point to deciding you're going to take that attitude is something. Maybe you don't succeed 100%, but sometimes you have to just stop for a second and say, now's the time to feel something. Because it probably won't come to you spontaneously, at least not when you really want it to, if you don't make that effort.
Yeah. First of all, how long will that metaphor be grounded?
Well, you know,
that metaphor of the old film.
Not much longer.
I think it's already history.
Well, I
think it's already
history. This group understands.
This group understands. No, what a lovely metaphor, because... What a lovely metaphor, because it's true that I think that what you're describing is the routine, right? Hergel is what we call it. And the notion that hergel can create the very, very high state of the post-action kavanah, instead of before intentionality, the joy that arises, the spiritual high, the elation, and the power of all that, I think is very, very much part of what's stitched in. And I don't think that you can completely, even if Muffs wants to say, if we read him in the extreme, that he wants to say, well, it has really nothing to do with the emotional kind of joy that we're talking about now. I don't think he could say it. Frankly, I don't think Leibowitz, in his less, in his hyper-rational state, really lets enough humanity to become part of the stitching in the fabric of Jewish culture that he agrees is so important, right? Because the article will say, and I'll come to you in a second, the article will say the ritual state of joy included at least five discrete behaviors as we can identify them in the literature. Listen to what the five are, right? Eating and drinking, sex, praise, festive attire, and anointing with oil. Very close. I mean, we still praise on Yom Kippur, but we take those away. If Yom Kippur is a day that's supposed to create the joy, what are we doing? We're taking those away, maybe to consider our joy, whether we were willing to fulfill those laws on each of the holidays, or what we glean and gain from them, right? And what we glean and gain from them seems to be much more poignant than whether we were fulfilling those laws on regular Sabbaths or on Yontifs, to eat and drink, to have marital sexual relationship, to anoint ourselves, to wear festive attire, right? Seems to be that there's something deeper there, and that we want to achieve something much more deeper. Interestingly, this article will go on in terms of ritual development to try to understand where these rituals come from and what, you know, which we're doing. We're asking those questions each time and getting more insight and new insight into why these five again and why Yom Kippur really came out to be the Yom Kippur it is. Just he says, which is kind of a passing thing here, Near Eastern ritual mourning behaviors for many cultures included fasting, mourning culture, fasting, sexual continence, abstaining from praise and reciting laments, tearing one's clothes and putting on sackcloth and sprinkling dust and ashes on the head. So some parallel to some versions of mourning, meaning, the question for Yom Kippur is, does some of that play into this? Or shall we say that for Yom Kippur itself, that this is at the end of the article, on the Day of Atonement, there is definitively a connection to mourning, as the rabbis created certain mourning customs. Listen to what they created, both in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. It's been taught these are the actions which are forbidden to a mourner for 1 week: bathing, anointing, putting on sandals, having sexual relations, cutting the hair, washing one's clothes. They also add in their sugya, reading the Torah, reciting midrash, halachas, and agadot, voicing a greeting, and doing work. And so, by the end of the article, we're asking, wait a minute, was it about joy at all, refraining from these? Was it about considering joy and the implications of all those things we usually do, and how we reduce it today, but with that understanding we gain joy and simcha and delight, and then go back to it, and go sit and make a new relationship with it all, and then joyously move out of Yom Kippur, where we could have experienced even death, and then we move out, and we go and we renew our relationships with all those kinds of areas, because those are the fundamental and foundational areas of joy in our lives, right? That's one way of thinking about it ritually. Or, by the end here, in what's included in this article, my question was, or, if it's really connected with what was going on with mourning, it's about the rituals of Yom Kippur are about the lack of complete joy in life, especially when it comes time that we mourn someone's death. The activities of the mourner become the rubric for the Yom Kippur set of customs and practices in order for us to go through this one-day period of deeply mourning what? Then you have to start asking, what are we mourning? Potential for having brought such goodness into the world, for fulfilling God's law, for living a life of Torah mitzvot, rabbinically, for feeling a sense of fulfillment in life, the personal, the more personal introspection kind of pieces, the missing our mark when it comes to penitential activity, not realizing that we've done some sins and needing a day to understand what we did and then to move forward and make tshuva, make that repentance and return, and then move forward. So therein lies the question of Yom Kippur again. What are we really trying to get at with these Yom Kippur rituals? And the article we looked at the last time and the texts we're reading and we'll continue to read are really asking us to consider what's the nature of the what's the nature, and again, this is a very different way of reading Gemara, but what's the nature of the ritual practices in this Mishnah, that's our Mishnah that we started with? What's the nature of what we asked you to do, and what meaning do you glean from it, and what's connected to these rituals? Because you can't talk about mana in such a deep way just because you're riffing off of maybe a day when you thought you needed to fast in the desert. Or maybe that's it. So this discussion about man that we're going to now return to in the Gemara, with all that in the background, will help further inform, potentially, why we do what we do on Yom Kippur. But at least now, with the two articles we've looked at in Qumran, we see that there are possibilities, there are two different kinds of possibilities at least, when it comes to thinking about why we fast, why we don't drink, why we have sexual continence, etc.
The lack of simcha, is it inui?
That's a good question. That's one of the fundamental questions in the Gemara. Now and then, you'll see in the Gemara's unfolding set of questions, texts, they're going to stop and now and then go come back to that verb and say, is this inui?
Because if the lack of the simcha is inui, we cannot celebrate Yom Kippur, because having the mitzvah of Yom Kippur, I need to be happy to obey the mitzvah.
Yeah.
So the spiritual joy, the simcha, the spiritual simcha, by obeying the laws of Yom Kippur, should make me happy. But if if lack of simcha is inui, we should avoid Yom Kippur.
Inui is really gushing you, isn't it? I mean, to me, they're not opposite of one another. I mean, I'm agreeing with you. I think the inui refers to physical things.
Yeah, but when so he started the discussion,
yeah.
They put the definition of what is a simcha. Mm-hmm. So the only five things that they put there were only physical.
So you're right. You're absolutely right. But I'm saying that doesn't quite work.
Forms of simcha.
I think when God says "V'samachta b'chagecha," in my opinion, He only spoke about spiritual simcha. He didn't speak about any physical simcha when He said "V'samachta b'chagecha."
But the point is, it includes what you're saying.
So when the rabbis came and took away the five pieces of our physical world, they said, oh, this is inui. They didn't take away the mitzvah of being in a simcha mode.
Well, remember, davka, and this is another interesting part, it doesn't really even say v'samachta about Yom Kippur.
But it's a mitzvah that I need to obey. Lishmor et Yom Kippur.
Right. So what's interesting about it is that we don't even really have we have sameach and simcha by way of the cycle of yamim tovim of holidays that are aliyah l'regel, that are the Jerusalem based holidays. What's really interesting to ask is whether or not they really come as a central part of Shabbat and Yom Kippur, and so that comes much less often. They're going to come in rabbinic literature, and in Torah, what's going to happen? It's really not there for you. Simcha, the word simcha.
Right. Oh, related to Shabbat.
Related to Shabbat and related to Yom Kippur.
Okay.
So it's true, v'samachta b'chagecha, and then one time v'samachta b'chagecha v'ayita ach sameach. But a quick study of Tanakh will reveal that you might be talking about a whole different level of simcha as it applies to these other days, because it's not really part and parcel of the stitching of the Torah's language about these other holidays. That said, we're very much in the rabbinic mode. There were no days sameach like this, like the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur, and in great joy the Kohen came out, and these descriptions for Yom Kippur, meaning that it's stitched in there. So that's why I'm relating it directly back to Yom Kippur as the question. And by the end of the article, he'll relate it to Yom Kippur because of the same, I think, thought, like, wait a minute. Is doing all this and the lack of doing all this in relationship to Simcha itself, is not doing any of these things related directly to the idea of mourning? And thusly concentrating as we do when we're in that period. Like, how many of us have experienced sometimes mourning doesn't lead to this, but sometimes mourning leads to a real reflection on one's own life and the power of the time we have and the notion of what we do with all the areas of our life, including the very basic physical and the other pieces. And so, you know, right, so is it wrapped up in Simcha? And if we're asking the questions, what do these inuyim, what does la'anot ha'nefesh really mean, and we are blurring the notion of inuy nefesh at this point, because we're either, you know, really, really like punishing our souls, afflicting our souls, or we are finding some answers within our souls regarding these areas, la'anot, or we are like finding some other notion here, right? Within it, homiletically even, we're doing the job that the Gemara wants us to do when it comes to those rituals. Because the Gemara will not just put this Mishnah and this text together, this is my claim, we discussed this last time at the end, won't put this all together unless it's asking you to think more deeply about that which we're engaging every year. And at some point we get the blessing of doing it together in community, and that's part of what the rabbis were doing on a very real level for their people in the rabbinic era. Right? What I like to remember is that our learning now kind of mirrors and can reflect what the rabbinic era discussions were all about, what they were learning. Well, did the editors put this material over by this Mishnah, and did this material ever really coexist with this Mishnah? These are questions of scholars today. I can't tell you about this Masechta. No one really can. Other than to say that we have it in front of us.
At some level, what you're saying about the conflict between joy and inui is there. Remember this fasting and creates its own hallucinatory, or I can't say the word, whatever it is, experience which creates joy. The ascetics have moments of being high just from not eating, sleeping, punishing themselves, and that makes them
no doubt
closer together.
No doubt that
not opposed, but actually.
Yeah.
The same.
No doubt that some of this is about what you can achieve on that day, right? But the question inherent in what you're saying is, yes, it's about either joy or it's about mourning. And if I'm the ascetic and I'm interested religiously in what's the nature of what this fast is supposed to bring me, a feeling of great penitential reality in my life where I'm being forgiven, joy because I had the joy of eating all these years, and the joy of man in our lives as a people historically, and salvation that comes with that, remembering the man in the heaven? Or is it the mourning, because these are mourning customs, and what am I mourning for, a part of my life that is lost now, who knows, time-wise, chronologically, or otherwise, or the sin that I committed? These are the questions. So right. And fasting is going to help me do that. And these other elements as well. The food and the fasting piece is the first piece that the Gemara is exploring in depth. Right? The Gemara will, after this section we're going to learn now, get back to asking about all five and or six. There's a parallel in our Talmudic text to the Rishami that will ask about that, but let's go now back into the Gemara and see where we are. We had just talked about man. It's now, again, introducing this whole foray into the manna in the desert. I'm on 75A3, if you have the Schottenstein. 75A3. The Gemara continues to discuss the manna, now describing its appearance. See that there? All right, so it's going to say, and by the way, you know, the parentheses were, over the course of time, if you're looking at your Gemara text, words that were put in by editors, but that are not, quote-unquote, the official versions of our Gemara. So we generally, when we're reading the Vilna, don't read them aloud. Okay, so, Kazera Gad Lavan. The Torah states in Exodus, it was white, like what? Like a coriander, God seed, Gad Lavan. So the coriander seed, I'm going to hold this up. You've got it over there. The coriander seed is going to look like this. Pass that around. And the plant is going to look like this. And we'll read one more paragraph, and then I'll share with you some stuff from this great scientific publication about coriander. This is the actual flower, what it looks like. Okay, so also look at the words, though. What do you get from kezera gad lavan? What is a zera?
Seed.
A seed. So you want to keep in mind, what kind of seeds are we talking about in the context of Yom Kippur? Well, you're talking about food and planting and seeds, and you can't mention the word zera without thinking about the seed of human beings. That word immediately, hypertext, we do this as Jews, anytime words are mentioned that really have other contexts, we know zera is really about seed of human being. So there's, with plants, you know, they flower and they blossom and they bloom. This also refers, in my estimation, immediately to the sexual intercourse part of the Isserim, the sexual intercourse part. Right? So just keeping that in mind. Rabbi Asi says, Agol kegida v'levan kemargalit. It means that the man was round like a coriander seed, but white like a pearl. Okay, so you've got shape and color. Gemara now is going to recite a brighter Tanu Rabbanan. God. The Torah likens Ma to God. Gimel Dalit. Right? What is that by way of verb, by the way? Ged. God. In very short ancient form, that was like Tagid. Like say. Tell. Which is the heart of the word Haggadah and Agadah. Which in that ancient time did not mean a Haggadah like the one you use at your Pesach table. It meant a genre of interpretation and a production of that genre of interpretation that is discovering what is embedded in the words of Torah by homiletical discourse, by creating what has been called in English by even wonderful translators as legends, holy legends, divine legends of the Jewish people. Okay, God. The Torah says that manna is like God. Shedomeh lezera pishtan bagiv olin. It resembles flax seeds in the capsules. That is, the flax seed is also round, like coriander. That's what Rashi will tell you. And the flax seeds, you've handled flax seeds before? So flax seeds are these kind of like very, it's almost like they feel silky in your hand. And they're roundish, but they have little points, kind of like if they were growing off a branch, they would be like a seed pod. And they're wonderful by way of, they fall out and you can sprinkle them all around, but just a little bit of moisture, and it gets, the viscosity increases tremendously immediately. So it's this kind of image that comes to mind. Acherim omrim, but there are others who say, says the Tanaitic source, God, the Torah compares mana with God, shedomeh lehagadah, it resembles agadah, meaning shemoshechet libo shel adam kamayim, it draws the heart of man as water flows, and like the Torah is water and draws our heart to interpret it, man in the desert drew our heart to interpret it, meaning very much what it says, we interpreted the tastes. Tanya Idach, another brisa says, God, the Torah likens the manna to God, Shemagid lahem l'Israel I ben tish'al l'rishon, because it would tell the Israelites whether a child was a 9-month baby to the first husband, v'i ben shiva l'acharon, or a 7-month baby to the latter. Oh, it's now going to, man is now going to help us divine the answer, but not really divine it. It's going to now tell us the answer because we're going to, and I'll say it like this, instead of being a divination, let me explain how the Braita works. Lavan, the Torah describes the manna as white, Shemalbin, Avnotem Shel Israel. Hold on one second, that's going to say it's going to wipe away the sins of Israel. What's for us to know? It's for us to know, because a family went out and collected man every day, and the portion of man for the children would appear in that family's basket, we would know whether or not at the time the first husband who was going to pass away, and then she's going to get married very quickly right after that, according to the way this writer works, if he was alive and he sired the child, then the man would have been in the basket back at 9 months. But if the new husband was the one to have paternity, then the man would only appear in the new basket, and we say that the child is what? A 7-month baby, of course. It didn't matter that it could be 9 months. We'll call it a 7-month baby, because man, the manna, what? Malbin avnotem shel Yisrael, wipes away the sins of Israel. Malbin makes Laban, causes pure white. In other words, that white of Yom Kippur, innocence. So, you know, in the ancient world, they thought, they knew that a baby could be really born between the 7th month time and the 9-month time and still make it. Not as often as today in preemies and all what we know. So in other words, there's like a power here for the man to show you that everything's kosher in the houses of Israel. The notion of coriander, why would you want man to be at all connected to coriander? All right. So first of all, you could just say, it's got nice white flowers. It's the color, and potentially some of it might have grown and been eaten in a different way in the ancient world. Right? Certain kinds of plants, seeds for sure, are roasted over fires and eaten. And that provides a little bit of nice flavor, right? Seeds are very popular. But one kind of possibility exists from the brief description here of the crop. You see that this is a little manual, and each herb and spice is described by the International Plant Genetic Resources Institute. So if you're interested, it's a wonderful site. It's got tons of stuff. It's lovely. And each of the articles has the origins of the species and its diversity and the places where it's from. And what I'm usually interested in is the composition and uses of things mentioned in the Gemara. And so the uses, the use of coriander fruits are related to their chemical composition. The general composition of the fruit is presented in Table 2, the most, and that's telling you all the different kinds of essential oils that it has. Coriander has been used in medicine for thousands of years. The first medicinal use of the plant were reported by the ancient Egyptians. The plant. General references to coriander's medical uses are also found in classical Greek and Latin literature, and instructions to cultivate coriander are contained in the German Emperor Charlemagne's decree. The coriander fruits are believed to aid digestion. So, that whole pot. Many other fruits of plants such as this have medicinal qualities as well, but some are poisonous. Coriander is also used externally to treat ulcers and rheumatism. These and several other medicinal uses are recorded by some historians who were looking for the ancient use of what the ancient use of these plants and their seeds were all about. In India, the fruits are considered diuretic, tonic, stomachic, antibilious, and aphrodisiac. And they're used chiefly, however, to conceal the taste or smell of other ingredients in pharmaceutical preparations and to correct the gripping qualities of rhubarb and senna. Now, given that, what could be interesting, you don't know about these things, but you have to wonder how people ate in the desert or how people eat kind of plants that may be very, very edible but lousy, taste lousy, that if they had such seeds, it could have just been simply for taste. And traditions, oral traditions of the rabbis that we're going to encounter in a few texts and a few passages down the line, hold, which I never really, you know, until I read this the first time through, right? Have you ever heard this? They had a spice rack in the ancient desert. The Jews had a spice rack. They were given spices along with the man. So on the one hand, you had the Midrashic tradition that the man could taste like anything you want, but on the other hand, you have the Midrashic or the textual tradition that all kinds of spices are provided for the Jews in that time when man is coming down day to day for the Jewish people in the desert. Coriander being one of those wonderful ones. Anybody like to cook with it?
It's a wonderful
seed, and right, you can pop the seeds and fry them in whatever kind of oil, and that becomes like a wonderful kind of basis for fantastic tasting coriander seed. And cilantro leaves have their own unique kind of flavor, and those who love them, and those who think they taste like soap think they taste like soap, but they make for great green schug, right? the kind of pasty, hot, spicy dish to go with your meats or with your meals in Israel that really is in one edah of the authentic schug. There's arguments over what is the authentic green schug, by the way. But it is a combination of jalapenos, parsley, cilantro leaves, and a little oil with some red pepper flakes. Without some red pepper flakes, that's, again, up to the area. So, do you have a specific one?
Whatever is good, whatever. Yeah.
Ron, did your family have this argument? But interesting that they're going to bring this discussion of flavorings in. There's an aesthetic piece of this which says, again, you hear it fasting, think about how wonderful the world of not only food really is, but all the spices and all the herbs with which you have to flavor them. That's what I think is going on somewhat. All right, let's push forward. So it's taught in the Braita. At the end of that Braita, though, that they help you understand what was sinful and what was not. Right? So Rabbi Yossi is going to teach the following. Kashem, she'anavi haya magid lahem l'Yisrael, mashe b'chorin u'mashe b'sidakin. The prophets would tell us what's concealed in gaps, holes, and in cracks. Ka haman magid lahem l'Yisrael, mashe b'chorin u'mashe b'sidakin. So the man tells the Israelites what is concealed in the holes and what is concealed in the cracks. Ketzad, how is it that man helps you understand what's concealed in the holes and cracks. Shnayim shebaal lifnei Moshe l'din. Two litigants come before Moses for the judgment. Ze omer avdi ganavta. This one says, you stole my slave. Ze omer atag machartoli. You sold him to me. Amar lehem Moshe. Moshe would say, laboker mishpat. In the morning there's going to be judgment. How is the judgment really procured? Lamachar, the next day, im nimtza omero bevet Rabbi Rishon, if the slave's omer of mana, the measure of mana, was found in the house of the first master, biyadua shezeg ganavo, it's certain that is that this other litigant stole him, right? Because the measure of man, of mana, would come in the place where the person belongs. Im nimtza omero bevet rabbi sheni, if the slave's omer of mana is found in the house of the second master, biyaduish is emicharolo, then it's obvious that there was a transaction that was kosher. He's supposed to belong to the second guy, and in fact his measure of mana is in the second household. So far, are you believing it?
That's the way mana is supposed to work.
And that's the way mana is supposed to work. That's our tradition. That's our tradition.
They don't tell us how it turned out.
Where did I miss the part about the people went out to collect? This means you just sort of, you get what's right in your yard, so it...
Yeah, in a certain sense. Remember, like, only certain people were... we have other traditions. We're going to get to them in a second, and you're going, and you didn't miss it yet because it's going to come. Because some people were actually wondering the same question that you were. It's going to come in the Gemara. Who really has to run out and grab it, and how far they have to go, and who really has to just collect it because it's like... appearing there on your doorstep. V'chein, ish v'isha shebao lifnei Moshe l'din. And a man and a woman says, we have this problem. Ze omer hi sarachalai. This one says, she has wronged me. V'hi omeret hu sarachalai. She says, he has wronged me. By the way, a woman and a man here with voice before Moses. Just to note, like, where that happens. Not typical all the time that we get that kind of man and a woman bringing a claim and each having a voice directly before Moses. La boker mishpat, in the morning there will be a judgment. La machar, on the next day, im nimtza omer abavet bala, if the omer is found in the house of her husband, b'yadua shehi sarchala, she's definitely the one that would have done the wrong, and it's certain that she wronged him. Nimtza omer abavet avia, if her omer is found in the house of her father, b'yadua shehu sarachaleah, it's certain that he has wronged her. So that she belongs to her father's house, and he could have taken the oath back or something like this. What's the point? What's the point of including the story about man and adjudication, of seeing the man in the right person's house? Is the Gemara simply coming to tell us the traditions of the man while we're sitting here fasting on Yom Kippur? Well, I don't believe that. It's wonderful that we should understand the great miracle of being provided for in terms of food as we're fasting. That, to me, is the simplest read, the simplest next read of the level of what are we supposed to be thinking about by way of the inclusion of this story and the fact that we are fasting. On the next level, though, that it helps adjudicate and helps malbin et avnoteihem shel Yisrael, that it helps make obvious the sins of Israel, what's this story about man doing here vis-a-vis the overarching theme of the day of Yom Kippur? My sense is...
judgment.
Judgment! Absolutely, that through the connection to the fasting and the food and the man, here we have a nice story that says, listen, sometimes your sins are so obvious, they're sitting right in front of you, everybody in the world can see it, and you can't. That little bit of a here's what it means moment in what you're hearing has to be part and parcel of these texts, in my estimation, because it's not just teaching you a nice tradition about how the man's found in either his house or her house. It's lovely. If that's the musar, if that's the ethical teaching within the passage. What's that?
The key.
Right. Right. What's in the holes and what's in the cracks? By the way, when you read that, what's in the holes, what's in the cracks? Where's the hypertext, Jewishly? There is a hypertext to Pesach.
Is it Pesach with the candle and the feather?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. What do you think of?
I don't know what the words are, but in Shacharis there's something about the vessels and the of the body
Halulim, Halulim. You're thinking of that. Interesting, homophonic, but potentially maybe the body is the holes and the cracks, right? I mean, in the way that the tefillah has, that we are passageways and passageways and openings. The same language is not exactly used, right?
Yeah.
But I see it now. But I see it now in terms of what you're thinking. And I was thinking directly, it's checking by the light of the candle so that the smallest amount of chametz really that you leave there that you could have found is going to be problematic. And you want to get the chametz, the schmutz on your soul. You want it out. You want it out. Okay, keep going. Kativ. Uvaredid hatal ala machane laila. When the dew descended upon the camp at night, the continuation of the verse is Yedrez Amanalav. The man would descend upon it. The uchativ vayasa ha'am lakatu. And the people shall go out and collect each day's portion of man. Uchativ shatu ha'am v'lakatu. And it's written in another verse, the people would roam and collect it. Ketzad. How do I explain all this? How do we reconcile the three verses I have about this? Tzaddikim yarad al petach batehem. Here's Jay, your question. The tzaddikim, the righteous ones, would go to the opening of their homes where it fell right for them. Beinonim yatsu v'laktu. The average people who are they made some sins and they're generally nice people and they're generally righteous enough. They went out of the camp and collected their portions, Yatsu Velakatu, Rishaim Shatu Velakatu. They had to roam far afield and go the distance in order to go get their portions.
They were the best physical shape, it looks like.
Oh, they might have been. They might have been. And isn't it crazy how some of the most wicked, the Russia in our midst, are the most beautiful? I don't understand that. I don't understand.
This is because of the man.
It's confusing with respect to what we read before, though, because in theory, what this means is that evil people can go out, get the man, bring it back, put it in their hopes to prove the cases here before, where that's the evidence.
It didn't come yet. It didn't. When they went to get their portion, it wasn't included.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The measure, the Omer measure of man was not included.
So they didn't take somebody
else. Exactly, exactly. But it did mean that we had people who could go around and measure. And that the administration really, was really good and able to have a Bureau of Weights and Measurements that really knew this stuff. The Gemara describes the substance of the man now. Ketiv lechem. It's written that it was like lechem, bread. Uchetiv ugot. And it's written elsewhere that it was like cakes, ugot. Round like uchetiv v'tachanu. And that they milled it, or that they ground it in a mill. Ha-ketzad. How can you have three different lashons for the three different languages, three different words for the man? I can call it bread, I call it goat of cakes, I can call it something that has to grind up. Really? Tzaddikim lechem. No, the righteous got the bread. Beinonim ugot. The neither here nor there. They got the round cakes, and Rishayim tachanu berechaim, and the wicked had to do the work of grounding it all up in the mill. Right? Interestingly, if I take the hyper pashat and I go back and I say, what do we know now about herbs and spices and wonderful kinds of things like that, based on the science that's helping us read Torah in a deeper way, I could see that potentially they found some kinds of grains growing wildly that they made into bread. that there were possibly some other types of round, either plant-like items or otherwise, that they had, or that they could make cakes, round kind of cakes, that wasn't so bready and full of that kind of thing, in the desert. Maybe it was from some other grain, maybe not. And some tahanu, that they would grind certain things, was either a step in the bread making process, because they dried out whatever seeds that they found, or they found some herbs that had seed pods that they knew were not poisonous, and that they actually did add spices. And all these things are possible in the great wilderness of the Negev and the Sinai. So the more we actually discover about what was during that time in the desert to begin with, the more we really get it. And there's a great new series of the geography and the botany of the desert, and all we knew from that, and all we now know from that age based on finds, that makes reading the Torah really, really unbelievable in terms of understanding what we do about actions that were either spiritualized or expressed like this but weren't really, you know, explained, that we could find such and such in order to make such and such. Okay, Gemara's going to keep going. The heavenly gifts that accompanied the manna. O dachu ba'maducha. They pounded in the mortar. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav. Item Rav Chama Barabbi Chanina. And some say it was Rabbi Chama, the son of Bar Chanina. Milamed she'erad lahem li'Yisraelim aman. Tachshitei nashim. The verse teaches that women's cosmetics came down for the Israelites with the manna. Did you know that one?
So why they left the desert?
What do you think this means? Seriously.
I would stay there.
What do you think this means? Just if I had to now tell you, based on what I told you before about the botanists looking at it and the geologists looking at it, the desert. Probably means they found some wonderful, colorful... leaves that either had a certain rub, or maybe they had seeds that when you roasted had a certain coloring to them, and people used it as beautiful makeup. And there was nothing wrong with that, according to tradition. Davar shenidon b'medocha, and for these are an item that was pounded in the mortar. Uvishlu b'parud, and this was cooked in a pot, meaning you could take certain parts of it and cook, and use other parts of it for different. Maybe not the original meaning of the Midrash, but I think that's potentially the meaning. Amar Rabbi Chama, milamed sheyirad lahem l'Yisraelim aman ki tzikei kedera. Teaches that seasonings for making a sweet and aromatic cooked dish came down for the Israelites together with the manna. There's your spices. And the spices could have been what that created a certain type of powder, right? If you look at, let's say, finding in the desert coriander, and you take that kind of lovely earth tone that comes out of the pod itself, and you mortar that down, this could be like an applicable avak. We have
powder.
But what do you call that with makeup? Is it called powder? Yeah, okay, a powder. I thought there was a special name for powders that... What? Rouge. Like some kind of...
To me, this sounds like there's volatile oils. Because... the volatility that'll give you
the aroma. Yeah, that too. Okay. Another accompanying heavenly gift. Behemei viu elav od nedava baboker baboker. And they continue to bring Moses the free will gifts morning after morning. Remember, they were bringing so many gifts. It was wonderful. The Jews were so generous. This is the time, the only time, you know, the joke goes, the only time in history where the Jews brought more than was necessary. You remember that verse in the Torah? They had an excess of everything they needed to build the portable tabernacle. We should be so blessed. We should be so blessed. My baboker baboker, what is meant by morning after morning? Amar Rabbi Shmuel, Baranachamani Amar Rabbi Yonatan. I'm on 75A5 now. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani says in the name of Rabbi Yonatan, Midavar she'erad lahem baboker baboker, that which comes down for them in the morning after morning, they collected it morning after morning, in other words, Melamed Shiyadulahem Yisrael Avanim Tovot Umar Galiot Imaman. This teaches that precious stones and pearls came down for the Israelites together with the manna. Right? V'hanisi'im heviu et avnei shoham. And the Nisi'im brought the shoham stones. And the Tana says, Nisi'im amish. This refers to actual Nisi'im. No, that's just clouds, guys. You know, don't get carried away that it's jewels. V'chein hu omer. And so it states elsewhere in Scripture, Nisi'im v'ruach v'geshem ayin, clouds and wind, but there's no rain. Okay, so that can mean clouds. But meanwhile, the tradition holds that they actually had stones come down with them too, with the man, and they brought gifts from that. And who knows exactly why it has to be connected with the manna, except to say that what they found in the desert, potentially, was not only the gift of food, but also what? Stones which could be used for sacred purposes, stones which could be used for decorative purposes. And in the midst here, one needs to think about whether or not one should decorate and anoint oneself with these essential oils and with these kinds of stones, and whether the stones should be kept only for sacred purposes by way of the Kohanic practices. Now we're going to go back to the quality of the man. V'haya ta'amo k'ta'am l'shad ha'shamin. And its taste was the taste of dough kneaded with oil. Amar Rabbi Abahu, Ma shad ze tinok toemba kama teamim, just like a breast, shad, just like a breast in the milk of which an infant experiences many tastes, based on what? Is the diet of his mother. Af haman, so too, with regard to the man, kol zaman shi Yisrael ochlin oto, all, as long as Israel ate it, Motzin bo kamatami. There were many tastes in the man. Ikadamre l'shed mamish. But there are those who say it has nothing to do with the breast milk and the many tastes that it has. That is talking about demons. Ma shed ze mitapech l'chama givanin. Just like a demon changes into many forms, so too af haman mitapech l'chama ta'amim. So too the man changes in many different tastes. Now, here's an interesting little passage. And again, I'm pushing readings that have to do with, what could this really mean in terms of our lives and the relationship we have to food? Its taste was like that of kneaded oil with shemen, right? And that there are many tastes. You know, I think that in terms of bread, it's very interesting how many different kinds of tastes different breads can have and how different people really like different breads. I find that fascinating. No matter what country I've ever visited, I've always found it fascinating that they have, like, they're very unique bread styles. And also in the city, thank God, you can get quite a number of bread styles, right? Just in our little stretch of neighborhood. And, you know, it's such a gift from God, like, breast milk is to a baby, so too the breads that you can find. And if you're ever in Israel and you walk and you go by these bread makers and they slap the pita or the lafa on the side of their little oven.
So the side edge is esh tanur, it's not a pita. Esh tanur in the Egyptian style.
Right, so very good. So you have this bread of the oven and you take this tour in the different areas and you try the different breads and they're fresh right out of the oven. They're baking whatever. The challahs are so different, one vendor to the other. It's incredible. Simply incredible, the tastes. So the very sustenance of life itself, the one basic food, can have so many tastes. And to appreciate that, again, as part of the text and what it's trying to engender in terms of, I think, appreciation, it's very powerful. It's very powerful. Then why does it turn immediately to say, wait a minute, it's got so many tastes, it's like a demon? If you ask some people, the great abundance of food and the great gift of food is very demonic in their lives. I know a lot of people who talk openly about their overeating problems because I've been in groups and I've spoken with groups about the Jewish notions of kind of being able to control appetites. And plus, you know, I'm from a family, I don't know about yours, that incredible amounts of people constantly on a diet. Some kind of diet, it's like a unique Jewish sport in a certain way. And food, for some folks, can be very tempting. Very tempting. Immediately overtake, you know, the part of the brain that you need reward, and it's also kind of survival instinct. I need to make sure that I'm on plate three just as I'm starting plate number one, and then talk about the survivor community and the whole relationship with food and the kind of power of food over that community when it comes to or apportioning certain pieces of this or that, so some is less and some is more, that food becomes in a certain way, to use the adjective of the Gemara, demonic. So from beautiful metaphor of variety of tastes at the mother's breast to food can be a demon. Yeah, this one small passage really hits a certain number of experiences within humanity about food that I think is just incredible.
Not to contradict what you said, but just a slightly different twist is there's be careful what you wish for. The blessing can become a curse, and presumably the curse can become a blessing.
Right, right. I think that could very well be part of it. It only adds to it. It only adds to it.
How do you relate that to the main theme, to Yom Kippur?
Well, I think every one of these small pieces relates to the whole picture of Yom Kippur in the sense that it could potentially be, and I'm saying this could very well be in terms of like a ritual theory about why we're fasting at all, why we're fasting from eating and drinking, that I have to deeply define my own relationship to food in the sense of my gratitude for it, my relationship to it, and its symbolic state within my tradition. So this is a piece of that workout.
And then from there come to fasting.
In a very different way.
In a very different way.
Yeah. And that's why I think the beauty of passages of Gemara like this all collected behind, if you will, the first Mishnah of this Masechet, is really wonderful. You fast in such a different way. Last year, we learned at this table all of the Gemaras and all of the Talmudic literature about different parts of the Seder, right? That just makes the Seder a whole different experience. And I think the rabbis really wanted for Jewish communities to have that experience. Other reflections on this piece? Am I right that everybody has like a certain favorite bread, or is that not a shared...
According to the description here, what is the man, it's tofu. Tofu is the taste of
everything. Tofu, it's tofu.
It's white. It takes the taste of everything that it's in.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Was there an ancient soybean that was harvested? This is a question certain people have asked. It's true. All right, let's keep going. See what else we can... The Gemara derives a lesson from the wilderness eating experience. Here are some lessons about eating. Vayomer Moshe b'teit Hashem lechem ba'erev basar le'chol v'lechem ba'boker lisboa. Hashem will give you meat in the evening to eat. This is from Exodus chapter 16. And bread in the morning to satisfy you. Tana mishmei de Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha. A bright is brought the name of Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha. Basar sheshalu shalo kahogen. Meat, which the Israelites requested, what do you mean? Improperly. They said they lacked meat and bread in the wilderness when in fact they had a lot of cattle. They had a lot of potential bakar. nitan lahem shelo kahog, and was given to them in an improper manner too. Lechem sheshalu kahogen, bread which they requested properly, though they didn't have it nitan lahem kahogen, it was given to them in a proper manner. Mikan lim da Torah derech eretz. From here the Torah has taught us proper conduct. Derech eretz. Shelo yochal adam basar ela balayla. So here's what we learn. From the way we asked and that we didn't recognize it, I'm not exactly sure how this follows, but tell me. You should eat meat at night. So if you grew up in a place where they had steak and eggs for breakfast, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. But the limud really is about eating when you eat a heavy meal, according to Rashi and the Maharsha. So,
just, how did this not wind up in one of the rules of kashrut?
Yeah, right? You can learn from an agadah, by the way. You can learn a law from such agadic passages, meaning legends of the Jews, if you will. But it does not wind up so much there, except to say that there are several places where there is advice not to get up and eat a heavy meat meal. A, you're likely to mix it with milk unbeknowingly, and secondly, it might make you very tired. Gemara goes on. But Abaye says, "Haiman to eat leisuda ta lo leochle elav zimama. One who has a meal should eat it only during the day, so that he can see the food he's eating." This dictum is seemingly contradicted by the Braita, which states that one should eat his main meal in the evening. And you see that the Gemara understands that Abaye meant the actual daytime, and that he's kind of arguing the understanding of nighttime, maybe as dark. Whereas others might have seen it as Erev, meaning not so dark already, but after the work day. Ein yamama kamrinan. One who has a meal should eat it only in a day-like setting, is what we're saying. The Gemara discusses an Israelite's eating regimen, or it's not really the exact way to introduce this part idiomatically. I think you'll see that there's kind of a tradition here that we went from picking at garbage to establishing meal times as a little bit of a lesson to you about, again, the way you should relate to food. Here's what it says, Amar Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov, B'tchila hayu Yisrael domin ketarnegolim. You were running around like chickens to eat, grazing and pecking and eating nibbles here and there. Except, Shemenakrin ba'ashpa, that nibble at the trash heap. Ad sheba Moshe v'kavalahem zman suda. Until Moses came and establishes meal times. Mana in the morning, meat in the evening, according to Rashi and the way that the Gemara says it. But the notion that we actually establish meal times and we sit down like people and we eat and we don't just constantly graze and we don't just constantly do... that's a principle that's going to come into play in the way we instruct people to sit down and eat a meal. The law codes later on throughout the centuries will say it's time to sit, you bless over the meal, you don't want to stand eating unless the custom is in that place to all be standing and partaking. So that's how we make Kiddush, for instance, like people stand around and they eat as opposed to sit down for the actual meal, because it's a community endeavor. But it was very important that the tradition come and kind of say to us, hey, listen, you want to think about eating in a proper and kind of organized and wonderful way. And this, too, also enhances the possibility that you will have, generation to generation, while you have any children around, educational opportunity. And it will enhance, friend to friend, family to family, the possibility of conversation over which you will bring Divrei Torah, you will bring certain understandings of Torah and wisdom, and you will invite the presence of God when you make a zimun, when you make a zimun, and you'll ultimately be able to pray together. So that meals and groups at meals become very important in the tradition. And here is some of the agadic work that are being that really helps us discuss this and understand this. Okay. The next piece is going to remind you, go to the right side, 75B1 on the right side of the page, and this is the last piece we'll do tonight, is that there's also very serious kashrut concerns that we have in our tradition, folks. And remember, my thoughts about the Gemara also in this Masechta and others say, remember, the rabbis are creating Jewish culture here. They're creating rabbinic Jews here. They're creating adherence to the rabbinic system. Right? And so they come up with ways of kind of also enclosing and creating the enclosures, creating the fences, putting things together, the man and the Torah's description of the man and the redemption from Egypt and your history, Jewish people, and you're one people and God is providing for you. And then it's going to be in Moses' name that we're going to learn this, but the next part is going to say, and remember, the laws that we defined as being the laws of kashrut, of keeping kosher, they came to Moses too. Because they know full well that the very specifics about keeping kosher, about shechita, about the way we shecht chickens and cattle, they're not in the Torah. The list of kosher animals is there, but all the laws are not. And so now they're going to embed a reference to the laws of kashrut and our relationship to kashrut as Jews reflecting on Yom Kippur. And they're going to talk to you about the origins of kashrut, and they're going to tell you it's Mitzina Moshe, from Sinai, revealed to Moses. So they do that through, again, hermeneutical kind of moves to wonder if different words refer back to ways to actually shech the animals we want to eat. Vayishtechu. And the verse states, and they spread out. Vayishtechu. Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, Al tikrei vayishtechu. Don't read that they spread out. Ela vayishchatu. Rather, that they read it as vayishchatu, and they slaughtered milamed. That teaches you shenitchayvu sonehen shel Yisrael shchita. This teaches that the enemies of Israel deserve slaughter. Ah, so now we're going to get into the big picture of the enemies of Israel and the historical epic of coming out of Egypt and the enemies chasing us ad hayom hazeh, to this very day where the enemies of Israel deserve to be slaughtered in terms of the current Roman administration. There's a little bit of a reference here in the midst of everything. Don't forget your history and where you're living as you're celebrating Yom Kippur. You always have to do it and put it in context. And now we're going to get it into, again, the laws that I mentioned. Shatoach, Tan, the Mishmei de Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha, Brighta, in the name of Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha, Al Tikure Shatoach, don't read that it was spreading out, Ela Shachot, rather that it was written slaughtering, Milamed Sheyarad Lehem Yisrael Im Haman, Devar Shetaun Shechita. This teaches that an item that requires ritual slaughtering came down for the Israelites along with the manna, along with the man. What was that? Amar Rebbe. Rebbe says, V'chi mikana talamed. You learn from here, V'halok varnemar, what's already been stated, V'yamter alehem ka'afar she'el v'uchol of kanaf. He rained upon the meat like dust and winged birds like the sand of the seas. The winged birds are going to need shechita. They needed to have kashrut ways and means in the desert. And it was taught in the Brit, the Rebbe Omer, V'zavachta kasher tzivitiha, you shall slaughter them, the cattle and your flocks, as I have commanded you. Milamed shenitzavu Moshe al haveshet v'alakane. This phrase comes to teach that Moses was commanded about the esophagus and the trachea, al rov echad ba'of, and concerning the severing of the greater part of one pipe of the bird, v'al rov shnayim b'behema, and the greater parts of both pipes of an animal, ela. And so that basically that's what it really means, that Moses was taught about the shechita of cattle and the shechita of birds at the time that the man comes down, and you're going to eat meat in the wilderness, and Before the Brita moves and says, well, wait a minute, I have a different interpretation, the understanding that we get is that, in fact, it's oral law, Le Moshe Misinai, it's oral law from Sinai to Moses, that we're going to have this for all time, and we have to understand that Kashrut existed at that point when they were receiving the man, and it links us back to that moment where God is providing each and every day for the needs of the Jewish people who were hungry, and this is holy law. That is accepted throughout the centuries and millennia of Jewish existence, that Moses received this tradition, that Shechita develops, that our way of preparing food develops, that it separates us culturally, that it provides a link to everything that's tied into here, the history and the desert experience and the potential for the meal to be made and the evening as the joyful time after the day of work and the post-Yom Kippur penitential fast or fast of like a mourner or fast of joyous occasion, whatever we're going to now say the fast is together, and that we're moving through this journey with unique kosher laws and recommitting to them. At least that's what I really think is going on here in these parts, recommitting to them as we come up out of our experience of Yom Kippur. Adkan.
Thank you.